Lecture 11, Plato versus the Sophists, Part 2.
In the previous lecture, we discussed one strategy that Socrates uses against the Sophists. One version, we might say, of his Elenchus, his method of refutation. Socrates is a master at exposing contradictions. This is true in a logical or formal sense. As you recall, through a series of agreements, Thrasymachus is eventually driven to contradicting himself. His very definition of justice contradicts the consequence of his own agreements. In a deeper sense, however, I think what Socrates exposes in his refutation of Thrasymachus is not simply a logical contradiction, but a psychological contradiction, a contradiction that's latent within Thrasymachus's soul. In this lecture, we will explore a second strategy that Socrates will use. This is called the argument from self-reference, or simply the self-reference argument. And in order to illustrate what it is, let me give a couple of examples. And I should say at the outset that this sort of argument has been used by many different philosophers, certainly not only Plato. Consider the following sentence. If I were to say to you, there is no truth, how might you respond? Well, you might indeed engage in this self-reference maneuver. In other words, if the sentence that I just uttered, there is no truth, is forced to refer to itself, then it negates itself. After all, if there is no truth, then the very statement, there is no truth, can't be true. Or imagine this. If you say to me, it is true that all truths are relative. If I apply the test of self-reference to this particular sentence, the same result might occur. If all truths are relative, then this statement, it is true that all truths are relative, is itself relativized. Why pay attention to it if it's merely one in a series of relative statements? As you might guess, it's this second sort of statement concerning relativism that's particularly at issue in the Platonic dialogues. One of the most ingenious uses of self-reference doesn't particularly involve Plato, but it's interesting to think about nonetheless, is what has come to be called the liar's paradox. Imagine if I were to say to you, I am a liar. Well, if that sentence is actually going to refer to itself, then if the sentence is true and I am a liar, then I'm not a liar because I must be telling the truth. The sentence self-destructs. What I would like to discuss in this particular lecture is Socrates' use of the self-reference argument in a dialogue called the Theaetetus. He uses this argument against Protagoras. Protagoras doesn't actually appear in the dialogue, but throughout the dialogue, Protagoras is referred to and Protagoras is named as the opponent. Simply put, and I referred to this in the second of my examples, for Protagoras, as we've discussed, truth is relative. If that's the case, then how in the world can Protagoras stand before the Athenians and make such a big claim for himself? After all, Protagoras is a famous teacher. He charges an enormous amount of tuition. He claims, simply by virtue of those activities, to be wise. After all, why should I study with Protagoras unless he has something to teach, unless he has some wisdom to dispense? Socrates attacks Protagoras precisely with the sorts of arguments I've just been mentioning. If, in fact, truth is relative, then Protagoras has no greater claim to being a teacher, to being an authority, than anyone else. In fact, Socrates is something less than polite at certain junctures of this argument with Protagoras, or at least with Protagoras's position. If Protagoras is to be believed that truth is relative, why not study with a baboon? Why not study with anybody you might happen to meet on the street? Why study with Protagoras? Protagoras, in other words, cannot ground his own claim to knowledge. He makes a claim simply by charging this very large fee for instruction. Once again, I would remind you that Socrates has no money. Socrates charges no fees. On the one hand, this is a character attribute of Socrates that is idiosyncratic. On the other hand, I think as Socrates appears in the Platonic dialogues, this point comes back over and over again as a contrast to the sophists. The sophists are the big talkers. They make the big claims. But their claims can't even stand up to the very relativism which is at the core of their teaching. In the Theaetetus, there's another use of the self-reference argument that I want to discuss. Socrates suggests that Protagoras's relativism is very much connected to Heraclitus, our old friend from an earlier lecture. In fact, he goes so far as to say that Protagorean relativism is nothing but the exoteric teaching which covers up an esoteric teaching, and the esoteric teaching, the hidden teaching of Protagorean relativism is actually that of Heraclitus. You remember Heraclitus? He is the great lover of flux. Everything flows. Nothing abides. Nothing is permanent. Everything is in a process of becoming. Well, what Socrates does with Heraclitus, and once again, Heraclitus does not appear in this dialogue, but he's identified very, very explicitly as the target of the argument. What Socrates does is apply the self-reference argument against Heraclitus. And he does so particularly with regard to the question of language. And his point, which I will roughly summarize, is this. If Heraclitus is right, and if we apply his doctrine of flux to himself, then the very language that Heraclitus uses to articulate his position must itself be in flux. If flux is the doctrine, then the doctrine must apply to itself. The doctrine is articulated in language, and therefore the language must be in flux. What this leads is to the destruction of the language that is used in the very articulation of the position. Much more simply put, what Socrates is accusing Heraclitus of is not making any sense. In other words, if he is right and everything is in flux, then he wouldn't be able to articulate his own position. One accepts flux, but if one does so, the price is enormous. The price is the intelligibility of language, because intelligibility itself, Socrates implies, requires some measure of stability. If there is no stability, there can be no intelligibility. Now, when we were discussing Heraclitus in an earlier lecture, I was trying really to prepare you for this particular point. And if you recall, we discussed his famous saying, "You can't step into the same river twice." And I mentioned the fact during that lecture that I work in Boston and my window actually overlooks a river. It overlooks the Charles River. On the one hand, it's very easy for me to accept Heraclitus' saying that I can't step into the same river twice, if by that he simply means when I put my foot into the river and the river is flowing, every molecule of water that touches my foot will be different. In that sense, sure, the river is always changing and I can't step into the same river twice. On the other hand, I give the river a name. I call the river the Charles River. The name seems to be stable. I'll call the Charles River that name today, and I will do so tomorrow, and I'll do so for as long as I live in Boston. What's the point? The point then and the point now is that language, from the perspective of Heraclitus, is inherently deceptive. The very use of nouns, for example, the Charles River, suggests to us, almost tempts us into thinking that there is something stable to which the nouns refer. I use the same word today and tomorrow and the next day, therefore I might think that what I'm referring to is the same today and tomorrow and the next day. This is precisely what Heraclitus must fight against. And if you further recall, I suggested to you that Heraclitus had an ingenious and really quite beautiful way of coping with this problem, or at least of responding to it. I suggested that the very way Heraclitus writes is meant to acknowledge this possibility, that Heraclitus is trying to destabilize language itself. He understands, in other words, something like the self-reference problem, and he's willing to acknowledge it by forcing his own language to constantly change. Heraclitus, one could argue, has no definite position. He has no stable position. He writes a series of aphorisms or fragments. If we compare one fragment to another, it seems to change. It seems to contradict itself. And the very logos which Heraclitus himself generates seems to be in flux. Can't get a hold of Heraclitus. Let me further remind you of some points I made in that lecture. I mentioned then that the great German philosopher Nietzsche was an enormous admirer of Heraclitus. And I think he admired him on precisely this point. Nietzsche understood that Heraclitus had arrived at a remarkable solution to the problem of articulating the flux. And the solution was to write in this aphoristic, playful, highly symbolic and imagistic way. I would suggest that Nietzsche imitates Heraclitus very often in his own writings. And at the end of his life, Nietzsche, in fact, is writing aphorisms. Nietzsche has no theory. He has no position. Nietzsche's very own work, like Heraclitus's, is meant to contradict itself, to play with itself, to move itself into transformations. Nietzsche, as I also have mentioned, is one of the most influential thinkers in the 20th century. And so many 20th century thinkers have tried to deconstruct language, a phrase that's associated with the French philosopher Jacques Derrida. They're trying to destabilize language. Now, why am I mentioning all of this? Because this is precisely what Plato objects to. While it is possible, one might think, for someone like Heraclitus or Nietzsche or Derrida to somehow maintain a position which affirms the flux, from Plato's perspective, this in fact will not work. It will not work because, for Plato, Heraclitus, and by extension, therefore, Nietzsche and Derrida, Heraclitus cannot offer a coherent articulation of his own views. Heraclitus, from Plato's perspective, fails the test of self-reference. If he is right and everything flows, then those very two words, everything flows, must themselves flow, and therefore we cannot identify a position and attribute it to Heraclitus. I've mentioned Nietzsche and Derrida, And one reason I've done so is because Nietzsche, in his own mind, has no greater opponent than Plato. In fact, one might think of all of Nietzsche's writings as being fundamentally anti-Platonic. Plato demands stability. Plato demands coherence. Plato demands that any articulation pass the test of self-reference. Nietzsche, much like Heraclitus, his favorite Greek philosopher, says, I don't need to do those things. My job is fundamentally different from the job Plato identifies for himself. My job is not only to articulate a position, but to do so in a way that coherently expresses it. And the way to do that is through, like Heraclitus, this highly aphoristic, playful sort of writing. As a final footnote to all of this, Derrida, also the famous 20th century deconstructionist, would also identify Plato as one of his major opponents. Let me reformulate this position. Socrates, in the Theaetetus, attacks Protagoras. He accuses him of failing the test of self-reference. He attacks Heraclitus. He argues that Heracliteanism ultimately leads to incoherence. As I've said repeatedly in the previous two lectures, the purpose of a Platonic dialogue is very frequently to demand of the reader to think through the variety of positions that are present in the dialogue. What I think Plato is doing in the Theaetetus, therefore, is presenting the reader with a choice. And the choice, to use a word I mentioned several lectures ago, is between logos. Logos understood in the way that Parmenides would have understood it. Logos as rational discourse. Discourse obedient to the principle of non-contradiction. The principle which demands that one not contradict oneself. The choice is between logos and muthos. Muthos is storytelling. It's poetry. From Plato's perspective, Heraclitus is not offering a logos at all. It is far too incoherent. It is much more like a muthos. Now, what this implies is something else. And this is, again, a pervasive theme in the Platonic dialogues. From Plato's perspective, there is a very deep affinity between the sophist, like Protagoras, the relativist, and the poet, like Hesiod, who engages in muthos. Both the sophist and the poet reject the possibility of logos. They reject the possibility of stable reference. Both the sophist and the poet have a view of the world which is fundamentally that of Heraclitus. The world flows, nothing is stable, nothing is permanent. There is no human possibility of articulating the structure of reality. Throughout dialogues like the Gorgias, which is named after a famous sophist, the Protagoras, a dialogue which obviously is named after Protagoras, Socrates will draw this link between the sophists, who are his mortal enemies, and the poets. It's little surprise, then, that in the Republic, Socrates criticizes the poets. And I want to mention a couple of ways in which he does that. The Republic begins, as I mentioned in the previous lecture, with the question, what is justice? In order to answer this question, Socrates says at the beginning of Book 2, it won't be enough simply to follow the logic of the argument. What we must do, says Socrates, is actually construct an imaginary city. What the Republic will attempt to accomplish is the construction of a perfectly just city. After all, says Socrates, city is a very big thing. If we can construct in our imaginations, using our ability to think the problem through from beginning to end, we can construct a perfectly just city. We will be able to see justice. We will be able to answer the question, what is justice? And that, in fact, from Book 2 of the Republic until the end of Book 8 of the Republic, is the project of the Republic. In Books 2 and 3 of the Republic, Socrates severely criticizes the poets. And in fact, what he proposes is a strict policy of censorship. He is fully willing to censor what the poets have to say, and that's because the poets are such a dangerous threat to the rational integrity of this city. In Book 10 of the Republic, he even goes further and he banishes all poets, at least all poets who engage in imitative poetry, which is what he calls it in Book 10, from the perfectly just city itself. In the later stages of the Republic, Socrates mentions what he calls the old quarrel between philosophy and poetry. In other words, he's identifying precisely the theme that I'm now developing, that there is a fundamental hostility between the philosopher with his commitment to logos and the poet with the commitment to mousos. And therefore, as I've just mentioned, in fact, the poets will virtually be banished from the perfectly just city, the perfectly just and the perfectly rational city. This is a feature of Plato's thinking, which is notorious. Plato's hostility to the poets, which I have now argued is exactly parallel and really emerges from his hostility to the sophists. Let me now, however, do exactly what I did at the end of the previous lecture. Let me, and this is certainly not my doing, I believe it's Plato's doing, let me throw a monkey wrench into this whole operation. In the history of Western philosophy, there are few, if any, philosophers who could match Plato's seeming hostility to the poets. We're very tolerant, or many people at least are very tolerant, of Plato's hostility to the sophists. But poetry is something that many people hold so dear, and we find Socrates time and again attacking the poets, notoriously in the Republic. So we have this image of Plato as the hater of poetry. And there is certainly warrant for that image. The warrant comes from the texts I've mentioned. However, the monkey wrench that I'm about to throw into all of this is that Plato himself is a poet. After all, as I've said repeatedly in the previous two lectures, Plato wrote dialogues. And what is a dialogue except, in its own way, a kind of mousos? It's a story. The Republic begins, for example, I went down yesterday to the Piraeus. This is Socrates speaking. He is telling the story of what he did yesterday. In the Republic, we have characters who interact. We have a character, namely Thrasymachus, who gets very angry. We have a character who becomes ashamed. We have a hero, Socrates. And clearly, Socrates is almost a mythic figure in Plato's dialogues. In the Republic, for example, which is an enormously long dialogue, Socrates speaks and speaks and never seems to get tired. He is promised dinner in the Republic, but dinner never arrives. But he doesn't seem to harm him. He just keeps going. In the Symposium, a dialogue I've mentioned before, he talks all night. He drinks all night. The following morning, when everybody else has passed out, Socrates gets up as if nothing had happened, and he goes to the gym to work out. This is clearly a mythic sort of figure. What's happening with this monkey wrench that I'm describing? We have, in other words, a poetic criticism of poetry. Is Plato a poet there? I don't think so. What I believe he's doing, and what I've suggested several times now, I believe he's doing, is forcing the reader into a kind of self-examination. The dialogues themselves are like living speech. That was the theme that I elicited from the Phaedrus. It is immensely difficult to get a hold of Plato. Who is Plato? Is Plato a poet, or is he a hater of poetry? In a certain sense, he's a little bit of both. His dialogues, therefore, we might describe as a kind of philosophical poetry, even. I'm not sure I'd want to go quite that far, but I would at least like you to entertain that possibility. As such, they are intrinsically elusive in the sense that the reader must now enter into these conundrums and try to think them through for himself. Let me look at this same point from a different angle. The title of this lecture and the previous lecture was Plato versus the Sophists. Clearly, in a dialogue, there is opposition. Socrates is trying to refute his opponent. In that sense, it almost seems like a game. It certainly seems like a competition. We've seen in this lecture that from Plato's perspective, there is a very deep affinity between sophistic relativism, which we now know, at least according to Plato, is nothing but a manifestation of Heraclitus's flux. There's a deep affinity between the sophist and the poet. So this lecture, which was titled Socrates versus the Sophists, could easily have been titled Socrates versus the Poets. What I would want to suggest is the following. The opposition between philosophy and poetry, the opposition between muthos and logos, the opposition between the believer in flux, like Heraclitus, and the champion of stability, like Socrates, is perhaps a quarrel, and that's the word Socrates uses in the Republic, that is perennial. Perennial is a word I used in the very first lecture. We turn to the Greeks and to the study of ancient Greek philosophy, not simply to collect historical information, although the historical information is enormously important. We turn to the Greeks because the kinds of issues that they took up are perennial. These are issues that are alive and well today. Throughout the history of Western thought, certainly throughout the 20th century, with the enormous significance of thinkers like Nietzsche and those he influenced, the quarrel between philosophy and poetry is as active as it has ever been. What perhaps Plato understood better than any thinker is that this particular conflict, this particular opposition, is a perennial feature of human thought. In other words, it is a basic human possibility, a basic intellectual possibility to conceive of the world as Protagoras does, as Hesiod does, as Heraclitus does. That's something that will always capture some people's imaginations. As I mentioned earlier, the group of thinkers, all of whom were dramatically influenced by Nietzsche, who now seem to occupy that camp, are today known as postmodernists. Postmodernism, from the perspective of the Platonic dialogues, is utterly familiar stuff. Many of the postmodernists think of themselves as very new, very revolutionary. In fact, in this particular case, there's nothing new under the sun. The postmodernists are precisely this amalgamation of sophistry and poetry and Heraclitus. What Plato seems to understand so sharply is that this is always going to be present as a feature of human thinking. There will always be sophists. There will always be poets. And the philosopher will always be in conflict with them. The Platonic dialogues are filled with conflict. Socrates manages to successfully refute Thrasymachus. This isn't always the case. Sometimes he succeeds and sometimes he doesn't. But he never puts down the fight. He is always bringing philosophical argument to bear against his opponents. And his opponents, I think we have now pretty thoroughly identified as, once again, the sophistic poetic conception of language, which was initially known as muthos.